39 by Eugene Field. This is recorded to celebrate the 9th anniversary of LibriVox. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. 39 by Eugene Field. Oh, hapless day! Oh, wretched day! I hoped you'd pass me by. Alas, the years have sneaked away, and all is changed but I. Had I the power, I would remand you to a gloom condign. But here you've crept upon me, and I am 39. Now, were I 35, I could assume a flippant guise, or, were I 40 years, I should undoubtedly look wise. For 40 years are said to bring sedateness superfine, but 39 don't mean a thing. A bass with 39. You healthy, hulking girls and boys, what makes you grow so fast? Oh, I'll survive your lusty noise. I'm tough and bound to last. No, no, I'm old and withered too. I feel my powers decline. Yet none believes this can be true of one at 39. And you, dear girl with velvet eyes, I wonder what you mean through all our keen anxieties by keeping sweet 16. With your dear love to warm my heart, wretch were I to repine. I was but jesting at the start. I'm glad I'm 39. So, little children, roar and race as blithely as you can, and, sweetheart, let your tender grace exalt the day and man. For then these factors I'll engage, all subtly shall combine, to make both juvenile and sage the one who's 39. Yes, after all, I'm free to say, I would much rather be standing as I do stand today, twixt devil and deep sea. For though my face be dark with care, or with a grimace shine, each haply falls unto my share, for I am 39. 'Tis passing meet to make good cheer, and lord it like a king, since only once we catch the year, that doesn't mean a thing. Oh, happy day! Oh, gracious day! I pledge thee in this wine. Come, let us journey on our way a year, good 39. September 2nd, 1889. End of 39 by Eugene Field. Read by Anusha Iyer, Mumbai.
Agent 9 and the Jewel Mystery by Graham M. Dean, Chapter 9. This is recorded to celebrate the 9th anniversary of LibriVox. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Bob Gets a Warning. The young federal agent returned to Car 43 and related in detail to Tully the result of the search of the train. "It doesn't seem possible that Hamza could be on the train, yet I am sure that he did not fall off," concluded Bob. "I've the same feeling," said Tully. "You're sure you didn't miss any place?" "We looked in every closet and compartment aboard the Limited," insisted Bob. "We'd have found even a fly if one had been aboard." Tully was visibly downcast, for he felt the loss of his confidential instructions keenly. "Hamza is the only one who could have taken them," he said, half to himself. Bob felt like telling Tully that he should have known better than to have opened and read them in the presence of anyone else. But he checked the impulse, and was glad that he had had the foresight to protect his own papers by placing them in his Gladstone bag. The train slowed to a stop at a lonely junction, and Bob went to the vestibule where the porter opened the upper half of the door for him. The federal agent, peering ahead through the rain, saw the train conductor make a dash for the station, where a night operator was on duty. The conductor ran back to the train just before the engineer whistled in the flagman, and Bob knew that already a message was humming over the wires, telling of the disappearance of Joe Hamza, the diamond salesman. The porter closed the upper half of the door, and Bob returned to the Pullman. The lights had been turned low, and he looked in at Tully, who was dozing. Bob was too wide awake to think of sleep just then, and he went ahead to the smoking compartment, where the porter had left an evening paper. Bob picked up the paper and scanned the headlines on the first page, but there was nothing recorded in the news there that drew his attention, and he turned to the sports page, where football dope stories could be found plentifully, for Bob liked nothing better in the sports world than a good football game. The train conductor came in and sat down. "It's a bad night," he said, looking at the curtain of rain which swept the windows. "We'll be late getting into Jacksonville. A message at the junction back there gave us a lot of slow orders where the track is going bad ahead of us. The rain must be worse farther south," said Bob. "It's nearly a cloudburst in some places. I wouldn't be surprised if we find a bridge washed out and get hung up for hours." The conductor was silent for a minute. Then he added, "I can't figure out where that fellow in Lower Nine went. Seems impossible that he could have fallen off the train, yet he isn't here." "I'm just as puzzled as you are," admitted Bob. "But I have a feeling that no harm has come to him. I sized him up as a fellow pretty well able to take care of himself." "I don't recall seeing him," said the train conductor, "for the Pullman conductor handles this end of the Limited. Well, I've more reports to get ready." He got to his feet and started for the door. The Limited lurched heavily, and the conductor was thrown back against Bob. "There we go," he cried. "The track's gone out from under us." The car was weaving and lurching as the wheels screamed in the grip of powerful air brakes, but the rhythmic clack of the trucks told them they were still on the rails. The conductor hoisted himself to his feet, and Bob followed him in a dash for the vestibule. "That blamed engineer almost shook us to pieces," groaned the conductor as he threw open the top half of the vestibule door and peered out. Bob, looking over his shoulder, could see a red glare that penetrated even the brilliance of the locomotive's headlight.
"Someone's swinging a fuse against us," said the conductor, buttoning up his slicker. "I'm going ahead."
Bob ran back into the Pullman and got his own coat. Tully, who was awake now, wanted to know what it was all about.
"An emergency stop of some kind," said Bob. "I'll be back soon."
By the time he was back in the vestibule, the Limited was grinding to a stop, and Bob swung down behind the conductor, the two running ahead alongside the train as rapidly as they could in the darkness. The Southern had been flagged at a lonely way station where it seldom, if ever, made a stop, and the engineer, who was leaning from his cab, bawled lustily at them.
"Find out what that hick agent means by flagging us down," he shouted. "We've got to get rolling again. We're 23 minutes late."
The agent, the red fuse still in his hands, came toward them, and Bob caught a glimpse of a telegram in one hand.
"What's the idea of flagging us down?" demanded the conductor. "I'm going to report you if you haven't a mighty good reason."
The agent's retort was sharp.
"Oh, quit your howling. I waved a fuse at you because I had orders from the super to stop this train and deliver a message to one of your passengers."
"What's that?" bellowed the conductor. "You had the nerve to stop the Southern just to deliver a telegram?"
The agent shrugged.
"You heard me. Now I've got to find this passenger and deliver the message."
"Give it to me. I'll deliver it."
The conductor reached for the telegram, but the agent backed away.
"Oh, no, you don't. I'm going to deliver this in person and get the signature of the man I deliver it to." "Hurry up there."
It was the engineer shouting at them above the noise of the storm and the air pumps on the locomotive.
"Who's the telegram for?" asked the conductor.
"Bob Houston in Lower 5, Car 43, replied the agent.
"Let's get going." "That's all right. I'll sign for the telegram," said Bob. "My name is Houston, and I'm in Lower 5, Car 43.
The agent looked suspiciously at him, as though he had not expected anyone as youthful-looking as Bob.
"I've got instructions to see a certain badge before I turn over this message," he said.
Bob reached into his inner coat pocket, drew forth his billfold, and produced the badge.
"That's right," nodded the agent. "Sign this slip."
He produced a pencil, and Bob, writing in the light from the headlight, signed his name.
"Thanks," said the agent.
Then he turned to the conductor.
"All right, now you can tell that hoghead up there to pick up his wheels and get the string of varnished gondolas out of here. I want to go to sleep."
The conductor snorted, but he was too anxious to get back to his train to make a reply. The vestibule of the forward coach had been opened by the brakeman. They climbed aboard, and the engineer whistled off the moment they were on the train. Bob looked at the damp envelope in his hands, and suddenly he felt himself shaking slightly. For some reason, the Southern Limited had been stopped at a lonely railroad outpost to deliver this message to him. That it was important, there could be no doubt, for he had been forced to identify himself before he could obtain the message. The coach was less than half full, and Bob dropped down in the nearest seat and ripped open the telegram, looking first at the signature. It was from Waldo Edgar, chief of the Division of Investigation. Bob read the message quickly and thoroughly. "This is to warn you that a man known as Joe Hamza, traveling south with you on Limited, is now believed linked with gang we want. Watch Hamza closely and take no chances with him, as his record is a ruthless one. In view of this, contact Merritt Hughes and Condon Adams when you reach Jacksonville." Bob read the telegram again, folded it carefully, and placed it in an inside pocket, with the feeling that even though Joe Hamza had disappeared from the train, they would meet, and that their meeting would not be far in the future. End of Chapter 9 of Agent 9 and the Jewel Mystery by Graham M. Dean. Read by Bev Stevens.
Section 9 of Doctrine and Covenants by Joseph Smith. This is recorded to celebrate the 9th anniversary of Whipple Fox. All Whipple Fox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, visit whipplefox.org. Section 9. Behold, I say unto you, my son, that because you did not translate according to that which you desired of me, and did commence again to wait for my servant Joseph Smith, Jr., even so, I will that ye should continue until you have finished this record, which I have entrusted unto him. And then, behold, I've worked with F.I., that I will give unto you power that you may assist to translate. Be patient, my son, for it is wisdom in me, and it is not expedient that you should translate at this present time. Behold, the work which you are called to do is to wait for my servant Joseph. And behold, it is because that you did not continue as you commenced when you began to translate that I have taken away this privilege from you. Do not murmur, my son, for it is wisdom in me that I have dealt with you after this manner. Behold, you have not understood. You have supposed that I would give it unto you, when you took no thought save it was to ask me. But behold, I say unto you that you must study it out in your mind. Then you must ask me if it be right, and if it is right, I will cause that your bosom shall burn within you, therefore you shall feel that it is right. But if it be not right, you shall have no such feelings, but you shall have a stupor of thought that shall cause you to forget the thing which is wrong, therefore you cannot write that which is sacred, so it be given to you for me. Now, if you had known this, you could have translated. Nevertheless, it is not expedient that you should translate now. Behold, it was expedient when you commenced, but you feared, and the time is past, and it is not expedient now. For, do you not behold that I have given unto my servant Joseph sufficient strength, whereby it is made up? And I for a few have I condemned. Do this thing which I have commanded you, and you shall prosper. Be faithful, and yield to no temptation. Stand fast in the work wherewith I have called you, and a hair of your head shall not be lost, and you shall be lifted up at the last day. Amen. End of section 9 of Doctrine and Covenants by Joseph Smith. Read by Glenn O'Brien.
Nine Men in Time by Noel Loomis. This is recorded to celebrate the 9th anniversary of LibriVox. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The idea of sending a man back in time to redo a job he's botched so that a deadline can still be met, added to the thought of duplicating a man so there'll be two doing the same work at the same time, adds up to a production manager's dream. But any dream can suddenly shift into a nightmare. The receivers, two of them lawyers, had long faces when they sat down across from my desk in the office of the Imperial Printing Company. "Frankly, Mr. Shane," said the older one, "it is a very grave question on our minds whether we should try to continue to operate the business, or whether we should close the plant and liquidate the machinery and equipment the best we can." I was stunned. "I don't understand," I said helplessly. "We've been doing a nice business and at a profit in the year I've been here. It was my first big job, and I wanted to make good. I thought I had made good, but there they were, jerking the floor out from under me, and I couldn't make any sense of it." "Well," said one, "the business isn't showing the profit we expected." "What you need is a used car lot," I said pointedly. The elder man cleared his throat. "Now look, Mr. Shane, suppose we say 3 months." "What do you mean, 3 months?" "We'll allow you to go ahead for 3 months. If the business doesn't show a distinct upturn by then..." He raised his eyebrows. I swallowed hard. So that was it, then. They even had the date set for the execution, and I knew they intended to go through with it. Only a revolution would change that. I wanted that job. It was my chance to make a name for myself. If they should close the plant now, I'd have a black eye. You can't go around asking for a job and saying, "But I was making money for them." They'll wonder what else was wrong. I thought I knew why they were so willing to close the plant. It was part of an estate, and the way things were, it took a lot of their time each month for not too big a fee. But if the estate should be liquidated, well, figure it out yourself. This business was all mixed up between an administratorship and a receivership, and the attorney's fees for liquidation would be a percentage of a $100,000 shop. It could run to a nice sum. They'd sell out, collect their fee, and forget it. A nice clean deal for them, and no more worry. That is what I was up against, so perhaps it was inevitable that I should find Dr. Hudson, Lawrence Edward Hudson. That was 1983, really about the beginning of the scientific age in industry, and I dug this idea up out of the back of my head where it had been for some time. Dr. Hudson was the result. I did not label him efficiency expert, for printers have always been notoriously allergic to that title. I called him production engineer. He was a small, thin-faced man, with a face that seemed to all flow into a point where his nose should have been. And he started talking things over with me before he got his coat off. "Printing," he said, "is really the backward industry. There has been no basic advance since the invention of the line-casting machine around 1890, and possibly the development of offset printing." "That," I said, "is why you are here, to bring out something startling." "Well," he said, "you've heard the old one about the man who had something to do with each hand, and if you give him a broom, he could sweep out the shop, too." He leaned forward, his nose jutting at me, and said impressively, "Mr. Shane, we shall make that come literally true. We'll have men working in two places at once before we're through." "Okay." "In the meantime, there are certain old-fashioned fundamental principles on which we shall start. I shall be here at 7:30 in the morning." I should have known. Man, being mass, possesses inertia, mentally as well as physically, and therefore offers a certain amount of resistance to being kicked around. That applies to printers as well as to people. But at that time I was too worried. I gave Dr. Hudson full authority. He was there at 7:30 the next morning, as he had said. At 8 the printers were standing around the time clock, waiting for it to click the hour. It clicked, but the man nearest it was smoking a cigarette. He punched his card and then stood there, finishing the cigarette. Dr. Hudson stepped up. "Gentlemen," he said, "it is now 8:04. Starting time is 8 o'clock. He looked at his watch and compared it with the clock. "Please do your visiting and your smoking on your own time," he said coldly. Well, it bothered me a little. I'd never handled them that way. And anyway, who cared about 5 minutes? The men would set just so much type, or do so much work. If they lost 5 minutes in one place, they generally made it up somewhere else. But this was Dr. Hudson's job. It was nice that there had been no insolence, only a couple of raised eyebrows. Dr. Hudson's gesture had its effect. They knew now who was boss. For the next few days they kept their heads up. Production did not improve much, but I personally had not expected it to do that. I think Dr. Hudson had not expected it either. It was about 3 days after Dr. Hudson arrived that a big job came in from the Legal Publishing Company, a 3-volume, 4,000-page record for the U.S. Circuit Court. They could not handle the typesetting, so they farmed that part out to us. It had to be delivered exactly 1 week before the deadline that had been set by the receivers for closing the plant. I very nearly turned it down, but Dr. Hudson's eyes glittered when he saw it. "Just what we need," he said. "That's almost 2,000 galleys of type," I reminded him, "besides our regular stuff." I was very dubious. But Dr. Hudson was enthusiastic. "We'll make history," he promised. Well, we did. Union or not, the men would have to learn to do the things the modern way. That is what I told the chairman when he protested against having the men go back in time to set a job over. That had been my first idea, executed by Dr. Hudson. As I said, Dr. Hudson was an experimental physicist. He was, you might say, a superphysicist, because he had specialized in finding ways to do all the things which traditionally were impossible, like traveling in time. So when the monotype Casterman set a job in Caslon that should have been set in Century, I turned him over to Dr. Hudson. The doctor took him into the laboratory and sent him back 2 days in time and had him do the job over, but right. The Casterman didn't like it, but he didn't know what to do about it. There was plenty of buzzing that afternoon among the men, especially when the job, reset in the correct face, or rather, set in the correct face, because this now was the first time it had been set, was put on the dump. I gave the boys 5 minutes to crowd around and look at the proof, and then I broke it up. I was exultant. It didn't occur to me then that a man could be too ambitious. That afternoon the chairman came in, and I was ready for him. "We are not," I pointed out, "violating our union contract." "But you made the Casterman set the job twice, and he doesn't get paid for it." "We pay the Casterman $2 an hour for 7 hours a day. When he's here more than 7 hours, he'll get time and a half," I said triumphantly. The chairman frowned, but I didn't relax. I was on top, and I knew it. "He set the job wrong in the first place," I pointed out, "and he got paid for that. Is there any reason why he shouldn't correct his own mistake if it doesn't take any of his time?" "It does take time," he insisted. "No, he's only reliving that 4 hours and doing the job right instead of wrong. You can't find any fault with that." And he couldn't. I felt wonderful. I wanted to jump and shout, but I compromised by taking Dr. Hudson down for a gleeful drink and planning our next tactic. We also settled a point of strategy. We decided to confuse him with a few minor things before springing our next real item, which would be, to put it mildly, revolutionary. Things looked pretty good. The only thing that bothered me was that we hadn't started the big job yet. The next morning, I saw a new face at the keyboard of one of our line-casting machines. I had long ago adopted democracy as a good policy, so now I stopped to introduce myself. "I'm J.J. Shane, the manager." His hands, with incredibly long fingers, had been just flowing over the keyboard. That is the only way to describe it. With the long fingers moving down an inch or so whenever they were above the right key, and doing it all so smoothly, it was hard to realize he was actually composing lines. His hands seemed to flow back and forth like the tide. And yet he was setting 20 M's, 8-point, and keeping the machine hung. Here, I thought right away, was a valuable man. This fellow could be a pace-setter, if we would handle him right. But when I spoke to him and held out my hand, he looked at me for a second without missing a stroke. Then his hands dropped away from the keyboard, and he started to unfold himself from the chair. "You don't need to get up," I said hastily. "I don't want to take up any of your time." But he finished unfolding himself and stood up. "I have plenty of time," he said. He was over 7 feet tall, and that meant a foot and a half over me, and very thin. His clothes looked pretty weather-beaten, as if maybe he'd been caught in a few rainstorms. "Jones," said his booming voice from somewhere far above me. "High Pocket Jones, sometimes known as the Dean of Barnstormers." I leaned back to look up at him. His face was as weather-beaten as his clothes. I recognized the reddish tan that comes from facing a hot wind on the top of a moving boxcar. He was obviously a bum, and probably wouldn't be with us long. But there was something almost of nobility in his eyes. Calmness, gentleness, or perhaps just the knowledge of having been in many, many situations, and the experience gained from getting out of them, and the self-assurance that he would always be able to get out of any situation. I reached up to shake hands. "Yes, I've heard of you," I said. "You're sort of a throwback to the days when they needed barnstormers to correct bad working conditions, aren't you?" He chose to pass that remark. "I've heard of you, too," he said, that last word sounding like the low string of a bull fiddle. I laughed quickly but efficiently. "Shortly," I believe they called it. "Nothing good, I hope." High Pocket Jones paused a minute before he answered. "Not bad, until lately." It took me a moment or two to realize what he had said. I bent back to look at his face. He was quite sober about it. "Okay," I said hastily. "I don't want to keep you from your work." I worried a little about High Pockets. I had heard a lot about him. He was a sort of mystery man in the printing business, going from place to place wherever printers felt they were having trouble, and trying to straighten things out. The stories about him indicated that he had some odd ways of doing that, based largely on a sort of legendary influence that he had over machinery. I remembered even the theory that all machinery was negatively charged with some sort of personal electricity, and that high pockets, having been hit by lightning, had a terrifically high charge of positive electricity of the same sort, which enabled him to do miraculous thing on occasion with machinery, especially line-casting machines. Well, I dismissed that as a bunch of talk. But what I didn't quite like was the fact that high pockets traditionally appeared in places where he was needed to straighten out things for the men. I went into conference with Dr. Hudson, and he agreed with me that we should go right ahead, but we'd keep an eye on High Pockets Jones. And at the first sign of interference, Mr. Jones would find himself in a great deal of trouble. I would even, I decided, stoop to having him thrown in jail on a phony charge, if that should be necessary. By this time we had started on the legal printing company job, and we went ahead with our next offensive. Mind reading came first. Dr. Hudson installed a black box at the water fountain, and he explained to the men what it was for. He had a private wire to his desk, and a transformer that turned the current from the box back into thoughts. It was quite efficient. Some of the thoughts we got the first day were vituperative. Some were quite obscene, and some were pretty feeble. But that didn't matter. It got the boys to worrying, and it saved us a bottle of spring water a day. Then there was the installation of the Lucite piping. Of course, seeing in curves had been possible for years, but never on this scale. We piped Lucite to every place where a man worked, so we could now throw a switch in the inner office and check on every man in the shop without their knowing it. That was a very clever device. It really put the men on the spot. Once in a while, when I needed to relax, I would flip a switch and throw High Pockets Jones' machine on the screen. The smooth rhythm of those flowing hands was more soothing than a lullaby, especially because I knew how much type they were getting up. Then we advanced to the third step in our strategy, having a man in two places at once. Dr. Hudson finished making his cabinet filled with coils and transformers and condensers and circuits I'd never heard of, and we set it up in the composing room one night. It was that night that full realization hit me that we had set only 200 galleys of type out of the 2,000 on the legal printing company job, and that there were only 2 weeks left to get it out. Somehow or other, I had let it slip by. I thought Dr. Hudson was watching those things. I had been busy trying to make an impression for the receivers. I was sick when I figured it all out. We had 6 machines. If we should run those 6 machines 2 shifts a day, our capacity was about 360 galleys a week. Into 1,800, that goes considerably more than 2 lines. We would need 5 weeks of full production, and we couldn't possibly give it full production. We had other jobs, too. The only hope was Dr. Hudson's new machine. The next day, the electricians hooked it up to a 1,200-volt feed line, and by noon it was ready to go. At 12:30, as soon as the men punched in, I called them together. This was on office time, of course, so there couldn't be any squawk. Dr. Hudson was there to explain. I never had fully realized how much of him was nose before I watched him that day. "Gentlemen," he said, "this is nothing to be afraid of. This is merely a modern device to assure continuous production in the composing room by eliminating lost time from sickness and accidents. As you know, if a linotype operator is ill, his machine goes untouched. That day's production is lost. At cost per man of around $10 an hour, that represents a considerable loss." He opened a cabinet and showed them a comfortable leather seat inside. "There are 2 compartments in this cabinet," he said. "All this machine does is to produce, temporarily, an extra man to fill the sick man's place. One of the men present steps in here. I close the door, see that the machine is charged here on the other side with plenty of linotype metal to provide the material of atomic synthesis, press the button, and lo! The man in the chair is duplicated on the other side of the cabinet." High Pockets Jones stepped forward with his deep eyes fixed on Dr. Hudson. "What," High Pockets asked, "is your theory of this machine?" Dr. Hudson smiled. "I am glad you asked that, Mr. Jones, very glad. This process is in no sense a separation or thinning out of the man in the chair. It is, in reality, an unusual extension of the well-known fact that nature tends to follow a pattern. If you want to make a synthetic sapphire, you start with a seed sapphire, and the artificial process builds up on that. Now this machine, which I call an extender, is merely a far-reaching extension of the synthesis of precious stones. By use of a revolutionary type of three-dimensional scanner, which was invented by myself," he said modestly, "I am able to focus on a certain object from a certain distance and, if there is material at hand, synthesize an exact duplicate of the original from the scanner. It doesn't hurt the original in any way. You merely have two where you had but one." The men stood around bug-eyed and stared incredulously, all but High Pockets. "Is the second one alive?" he asked. "I mean, would you say it has a soul?" "That," said Dr. Hudson crisply, "is out of my field. I suggest you consult your spiritual advisor." The chairman stepped up. "You have tried this thing, have you?" "Thoroughly tested," said Dr. Hudson. I refrained from smiling. The printers were flabbergasted. They didn't know what to do or think. The chairman was trying to get his poor fogged brain together with arguments. The only person beside myself and Dr. Hudson who seemed to be at ease was the barnstormer, High Pockets Jones. "In other words," High Pockets said, "if we are short an operator, I can walk in that cabinet, and you can, in a few minutes, make another High Pocket Jones, who will set type until you put him back into the cabinet, and turn him back into 160 pounds of linotype metal." "Precisely," Dr. Hudson smiled and showed his teeth. I could see he was losing his patience. "Well," said High Pockets, "I can see about 900 legal questions right off the bat. Who is going to draw the duplicate's pay? Is the duplicate entitled to a union card? Is he entitled to overtime? Is he a man or an automaton?" "Sorry," said Dr. Hudson, "I am not a legal expert." High Pockets walked up to the cabinet and looked inside. I'd swear he looked as if he knew what all those wires were there for. His deep eyes took it all in, and then he announced in his booming voice from far above us, "You're waiting for a volunteer," he said. "I'll be first." I practically fell over. I think even Dr. Hudson was dumbfounded. We had not expected unconditional surrender. I was elated. High Pockets Jones was seated in the cabinet. Dr. Hudson threw the switch. After 5 minutes humming, a relay clicked. Dr. Hudson opened the door. High Pockets Jones, with a deep smile on his weather-beaten face, unfolded his long legs and stepped out, holding his head down to keep from hitting the top of the door frame. "How do you feel?" asked Dr. Hudson. "Excellent," boomed High Pockets, straightening up. The physicist went around to the other side, and though I had been watching these experiments for some time, I give you my word I very nearly choked on my own tongue when I saw High Pockets Jones walk out of the second compartment. The second High Pockets produced a worn billfold and extracted a pink union permit. "I protest this inhuman manipulation of a man's individuality," said the chairman indignantly. "This is outrageous." I felt better now. I'd been waiting for that. "Let him go to work," I said. "We need an operator today anyway. Bill Smith has the flu. I will guarantee to pay a man's wages to whomever you say if this is found to be illegal." Under the law, there wasn't much they could do, and I had already taken the precaution of retaining the best legal counsel in the city. I was elated when they went to work. I pumped Dr. Hudson's hand and assured him that we had indeed made spectacular history, and together we could make millions. The first trouble came an hour later. One of the hypotheses, I couldn't tell which one, came into the office. The foreman sent me up to get some work, he said in his booming voice. I frowned. What was going on back there? I went back. High Pockets Jones was working on his own machine. High Pockets Jones was also working on Bill Smith's machine. I looked up quickly. High Pockets Jones was also standing beside me. He smiled. Catching, isn't it? I swallowed, but I knew they were playing tricks. High Pocket Jones had walked into the cabinet a second time, and his double had worked the controls and produced a third. Well, this could get confusing. But I stayed calm. You're a floor man, too, aren't you? Yes, sir. Okay, you go back to the monotype room and get a bunch of slugs and leads and saw them up to fill the cases. They're getting pretty low. Yes, sir. He turned and went away. When I got back to the office, I thought I'd just turn on the Lucite and see what they might be up to next. I had an uneasy feeling. Sure enough, a High Pockets Jones was stepping out of the second compartment of the cabinet. I gulped and quickly checked the others. This was the fourth one. I went back to raise hell, but High Pockets, well, one of them, was quite calm about it. Two men can do it faster than one, he said. I licked my lips and beat my brains, but I didn't know the answer. I went back to think it over. I had just decided to laugh it off when three High Pockets Joneses came into the office. We need something to do, they said, all in that great booming voice that seemed to come from the ceiling. See the foreman. Tell him to give you all the standing type that needs to be distributed. They left. I breathed a sigh of relief and sent out for a padlock to be put on the cabinet. An hour later, with a nice, shiny new padlock, I went back to the composing room, but I very nearly fainted when I saw the activity going on back there. The composing room was filled with High Pockets Joneses. Two were still at the line-casting machines, and a whole crew of others were running around the floor. "Where's the foreman?" I barked. High Pockets Joneses, one of them, came to attention. He went home. He was quite discouraged. He told us to throw in all the standing type we could find. It didn't look good. I had the feeling that High Pockets was laughing at me. This High Pockets, anyway. That reminded me. I gathered up all the High Pockets in the composing room and lined them up. There were nine. Exactly nine. Every one of them over 7 feet tall and thin as a side stick. Every one of them with a gentle, booming voice. I wanted to tell the original High Pockets to gather them all up and put them back together, but I didn't know how to find the original. Well, they couldn't get me down. I fooled them. I told them to all take the rest of the day off, at full pay. All nine of them washed up together and left together. It was the damnedest thing I ever saw off stage. Nine identical High Pockets. All so tall they had to weave around the neon lights instead of ducking under them. It was enough to give a man nightmares to watch that line of High Pockets Joneses advancing across an open composing room. This kind of thing went on the next day and the next. Every day there were nine High Pockets Joneses in the composing room. Everybody was falling over everybody else, when they weren't standing around laughing up their sleeves. There was nothing I could do. I had been forced to turn over all of my house to eight of the High Pockets, because they had to have a place to stay, and, after all, I was responsible for them. Our production went up a little, but the legal printing company job was hardly touched. There was too much of that sort of festive spirit in the air. Everybody was watching the hypotheses and waiting to see what would happen next, and hoping for something extravagant. In other words, they refused to take it seriously. To them, it was a circus. I didn't have the nerve to ask anybody else to split. After all, High Pockets was in 9 places at once. That should have been enough. It was apparent by that time that the extender would never be anything in a printing office but a psychological monstrosity. I had to admit I was stymied, and I got so I didn't give a whoop. I was sunk anyway. That is the way it went that week. On Saturday night, Dr. Hudson and I got beautifully soused. On Monday morning, I didn't care. The legal printing company called up and said they could give us a few more days. If they could have it by Friday, they could still make the filing date. I said we'd do everything possible. And then I hung up and laughed bitterly and aloud. We couldn't get it out if we had another month. The only thing was, as soon as our plant closed up, they could ask the court for an extension because of unforeseen circumstances, and probably get it. So I laughed aloud. I saw Dr. Hudson cleaning out his desk and nodded. Sorry, Doc. We got all fouled up. Maybe some other time. He nodded. Progress always encounters opposition, he said. Just happens that we are the sacrifice in this deal. Yeah, I went out and had a drink. I was pretty dazed that week. It didn't make any difference. I had already tried everything possible, and they had me hogtied. And those 9 hypocrisies had made me a laughingstock. On Friday morning, I looked at the calendar, and it suddenly occurred to me that this was the 31st, and the receivers would be around this afternoon to decide whether or not to close the place. There wasn't any doubt as to what they would do. I began to clean out my own desk. I felt terrible. Then one of the hypocrites came in with a piece of copy in his hand. He looked at me queerly and then said softly, "You leavin'?" "Yes," I said bitterly. "I'm going. You got me licked. I'm through." "I was just trying to point out to you the absurdity of some of your new devices," he said. "Okay," I said, "you win. Guys like you make a business of going around the country breaking print shops and print office managers." High Pocket's booming voice came from the ceiling. "You are mistaken. I did not try to break you." "Well, you broke me anyway." I blurted out the whole thing to him, how the receivers were about to close us up, how the legal printing company job was weeks behind and was supposed to be delivered today. Then I apologized. "It isn't your fault," I told him. "I'm sorry, I didn't mean that. I just, well, I wanted to make good on this job." Hypocus was very thoughtful. "I feel kind of sorry for you," he said. "Oh, you don't need to. I earned it. I've got it coming. I was just a little too ambitious, that's all. I didn't know a man could be too ambitious." Hypocus looked at me. His deep eyes were thoughtful. I could almost see the neurons buzzing around in his head. "If I could get this job out for you on time, would that save the day?" "Probably," I laughed or tried to, "but it is now a physical impossibility. There isn't enough time." Hypocus said sharply, "Call a truck," and wheeled out of the office. I called the delivery truck before I realized what I had done. Well, it didn't make any difference. They could start hauling out the machinery. I finished cleaning out my desk and took a wastebasket full of papers to the back shop. And there, I give you my word, 3 hypocrites were busy carrying galleys from the type dump to the proof press. And as fast as they could carry a galley of type from the dump, another galley would just materialize there. I stood and stared. Galleys of type were coming out of thin air at the rate of about 4 galleys a minute. I went over to where Hypocrites, the original Hypocrites, I suppose, was sitting at his machine. "Would you please tell me what's going on?" I asked. "Well," said Hypocrites, "it isn't so complicated. I just sent the other 5 back in time to set this job, that's all. They've gone back about 12 weeks. And of course there isn't much time, so I had to make them double up. I've got them to split up into shifts, along with a double of the chairman there to cover the 6 machines. It's a little hard to explain whether they are split up in time, or the time-split ones are split up in place, or just what." "It's insane," I said weakly. "Well, at any rate, you see, you have the equivalent of 12 night shifts running at once, plus 12 graveyard shifts. That's 24 times 6. You have 6 machines, times 12. That's the number of galleys a day for each machine. I think it comes out to 1,700 for a day's work." I grabbed hold of the vice-locking screw to keep my knees from doubling under me. It was incredible, and yet it was true. High Pockets also had organized the proofreaders and copy holders, and they were reading in the past also, and sending us proofs in the present. If anybody ever tells you they can't get 1,700 galleys of type a day out of 6 line-casting machines, well, they just don't know High Pockets Joneses. "Of course," he said apologetically, "they'll want to be paid." I was practically hysterical by that time. "I'll see that they get overtime for every hour they put in." High Pockets looked at me with his deep eyes. "Me too," he said. I laughed when I thought how there were 9 of him working in 12 places at once. Or was it 24? Or maybe 48? I was too dizzy by that time to figure out anything. I only knew the job was going to be delivered. Truckers were going in a steady stream through the back door. Maybe the receivers would close the place, and maybe they wouldn't. At least the job was being delivered. About 4:30, the galley suddenly quit coming. The job was finished. Half an hour later, it was out of the shop, and I had entered it on the books. I had hardly laid down the pen when the 3 receivers came in. They smoked a little and talked, and I held my breath while they looked at the books. I couldn't figure out what they were going to do. One of them whistled when he saw the legal printing company figures. "Well," he said, "business has been good." "Fair," I said modestly. The door to the shop opened, and High Pockets Jones walked in. I gulped. 8 High Pockets Joneses walked in behind him. The 3 receivers stared. Their eyes stuck out until it was ludicrous. But it wasn't funny. I knew something was going to happen now. By the time the last High Pockets got in, the 1st receiver had seen what was going on and was trying to get out. But 9 High Pockets in one room are a lot. For a minute it looked like a basketball game. The elder lawyer looked at me suspiciously. "Please explain this." I was too weak. "See for yourself," I said. 1 High Pocket spoke to me. "Sorry, Mr. Shane. Just came in to say goodbye. Never realized..." "That's okay," I said. "You've done your part. I can't squawk." The attorney spoke up. "Mr. Shane," he said, "I think the affairs of the Imperial Printing Company are in perilous circumstances. I do not know what is the meaning of this, but certainly there is something here without precedent. And if you know lawyers, you know that anything without precedent is very unholy." I told him what we had done, but he was interested in only one thing. "Think what a combined suit by these 9 twins here would do."
"Non-tuplets," suggested one of the High Pockets.
"Why," the lawyer seemed to be overwhelmed by the enormity of the damage he was visualizing, "that could amount to millions." I was desperate for an idea, but it wasn't any use. They were taking it out of my hands. I saw the righteous light in the eyes of those men, and I knew it was all over. But High Pockets, or one of him, spoke up. "Is it your intention," he asked me, "to keep the time machine and the extender?" "No," I said. "I rather thought I'd get rid of the whole business. It's much too complicated. Anyway, you boys out there came through with superhuman efforts this afternoon. I don't think I'd ask you to be in 2 places at once again." High Pockets turned to the lawyer. "If the receivers agree to let the plant operate as long as it shows a profit," he said, "we'll all go back together, and then you can break up the extender, and there won't be any more trouble. If you don't agree to that," he paused, "we'll stay in 9 bodies and sue you every time we get a chance." The lawyers winced. The receivers went into conference. Finally, they said, a little anxiously,
if the Messrs. High Pockets will be good enough to go back together, and if Mr. Shane will destroy the machine, we are agreeable to the plant's continuance as a printing office. Hooray! I said, and 9 High Pockets yelled, Hooray! I was exultant. I shook hands with each one of the High Pockets as they filed into the extender. When there was only one left, he shook hands with me. What's the matter? I asked. Nothing at all, said High Pockets Jones. Just got a call this morning from a print shop where they're trying to make the men wear roller skates so they can move faster. Guess they need me down there. So long, boss. So long, I said. I was sorry to see him go. I locked up the shop. But first I cut off all the power and got a pig and smashed up Dr. Hudson's coils and transformers. I wanted to come down in the morning without seeing double. End of 9 Men in Time by Noel Loomis. Read by Mary in Arkansas.
9月14日の朝、正岡子規。リブリボックス創設9周年を祝って録音されました。リブリボックスの録音はすべてパブリックドメインです。ボランティアについてなど、詳しくはサイトをご覧ください。URL、librivox.org。朝、替えの中で目が覚めた。なお半ば夢中であったが、おいおいと言って人を起こした。次の間に寝ている妹と座敷に寝ている虚子とは同時に返事をして起きてきた。虚子は看護のために昨夜泊まってくれたのである。雨戸を開ける、蚊帳を外す。この際夜は口の内に一種の不愉快を感じるとともに、喉が渇いて全く潤いのないことを感じたから、用意のために枕元の盆に乗せてあった甲州ぶどうを10粒ほど食った。何とも言えぬうまさであった。金景の露一杯という心持ちがした。かくてようように眠りがはっきりと覚めたので、十分に体の不安と苦痛とを感じてきた。今人を呼び起こしたのも、もちろんそれだけの用はあったので、直ちにうちの者に不浄物を取り除けさせた。夜は四五日前より容体が急に変わって、今までもほとんど動かすことのできなかった両足が、にわかに水を持ったように膨れ上がって、一部も五輪も動かすことができなくなったのである。そろりそろりとすね皿の下へ手をあてごうて動かしてみようとすると、大盤石のごとく落ち着いた足は非常の苦痛を感じねばならぬ。世はしばしば種々の苦痛を経験したことがあるが、この度のような非常な苦痛を感じるのは初めてである。それがためにこの二三日は世の苦しみと家内の騒ぎと友人の看護方々と行き来るなどで、病室には一種不穏の兆を示している。昨夜も大勢来ておった友人、碧後藤、祖骨、幸男、穂妻、隆は帰ってしもって、夜らの眠りについたのは1時頃であったが、今朝起きてみると、足の動かぬことは前日と同じであるが、昨夜に限ってほとんどまだなく熟睡を得たためであるか、精神は非常に安穏であった。顔は少し南向きになったまま、ちっとも動かれぬ姿勢になっているのであるが、そのままにガラス障子の外を静かに眺めた。時は6時を過ぎたくらいであるが、ぼんやりと曇った空は少しの風もない甚だ静かな景色である。窓の前に一軒半の高さにかけた竹の棚には、よしずが3枚ばかり載せてあって、その東側から登りかけているヘチマは、10本ほどのやつが皆痩せてしもうて、まだ棚の上まではえとりつかずにいる。花も2、3輪しか咲いていない。正面にはお見返しが一番高く咲いて、系統はそれよりも少し低く、五六本散らばっている。周回道はなお衰えずにその梢を見せている。世は病気になって以来、今朝ほど安らかな頭を持て、静かにこの庭を眺めたことはない。うがいをする。虚子と話をする。南向こうの家には、尋常二年生ぐらいな声で本の復習を始めたようである。やがて、納豆売りが来た。世の家の南側は工事にはなっているが、元加賀の別邸内であるので、この工事も行き止まりであるところから、 豆腐売りでさえこの裏道へ来ることは極めて少ないのである。それでたまたま珍しい飲食商人が入ってくると、要は奨励のためにそれを買うてやりたくなる。今朝は珍しく納豆売りが来たので、店内の人はあちらからもこちらからも納豆を買うている声が聞こえる。世もそれを食いたいというのではないが、少し交わせた。挙手とともに妻にいた朝のことなどを話しながら外を眺めていると、たまに梅雨でも落ちたかと思うようにへしまの葉が一枚だけひらひらと動く。そのたびに秋の涼しさは肌に染み込むように思うて、何とも言えぬ良い心持ちであった。なんだか苦痛極まってしばらく病気を感じないようなのも不思議に思われたので、文章に書いてみたくなって、要は口で綴る。挙手に頼んでそれを記してもろうた。引きしおいたところへ母が来て、ソップは来ているのぞなと言うた。9月14日の朝、正岡式終わり。
9,000 manuscripts from the Century Illustrated Monthly Magazine, Volume 40. This is recorded to celebrate the 9th anniversary of LibriVox. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. During the past 2 years, from 8,500 to 9,000 manuscripts were annually submitted to the Century Magazine for publication. This is an increase over previous years and does not include the hundreds, perhaps thousands, of propositions submitted with regard to articles. As there has been an increase in the number of periodicals published in America of late years, and as the newspapers are publishing more contributions than ever by writers not on the regular staff, it is evident that there has been an increase in literary activity, at least in proportion to the increase in population. Now, out of 9,000 manuscripts a year, the Century can only possibly print 400 or less. It follows that editing a magazine is not unlike walking into a garden of flowers and gathering a single bouquet. In other words, not to accept an article, a story, a poem, is not necessarily to reject it. There may be weeds in the garden, there must be weeds in the garden, but the fact that a particular blossom is not gathered into the monthly bouquet does not prove that the editor regarded the blossom as a weed and therefore passed it by. It would be impossible to sweep all the flowers into a single handful. The rejected, or declined, are naturally prone to jibe at sympathetic or apologetic words from editorial sources, so we present the above simile with considerable diffidence. There is truth in it nevertheless, and it would probably be much easier for editors to make up a number of bouquets from the flowers at their disposal than to gather the single one for which alone they have room. The general impression of a lifelong reader of manuscripts is that the quality does not deteriorate, that, in fact, it improves. Such a reader, moreover, is generally impressed by the wide diffusion of literary ability. There are certainly very many more people who can write a good story, a good descriptive paper, a good essay, a good poem, than there were, say, 20 years ago. An old manuscript reader is inclined, in fact, to be very optimistic. Even Mr. Howells' recent extraordinary praise of current literature may not seem to such a reader as so very far out of the way. But after the old manuscript reader has expressed himself thus optimistically, he is entitled to his buts. He may even permit himself to ask whether the literary artist of our day has not caught somewhat of the hurry, the immediateness of the time, whether indeed the present age is not too present with us, whether there is the slow, determined, sure, artistic work which made the successful careers of the earlier generation of American poets, romancists, and essayists. There surely is such work, but is it as general as it should be? And if not, is this one reason that there are not more literary reputations in the new generation, commensurate with those of the old? At least, the old manuscript reader may, by reason of his age, if nothing else, be pardoned, should he at times look over his spectacles at the young manuscript writer and say, "Young man, young woman, you have talent, you have industry, you have knowledge, you have a fine, large audience eagerly waiting for you. All you need is to respect still more highly your own unusual parts. Ponder over, perfect your work. Be not in too great haste to bring it to the eye of the editor, to the eye of the public. Regard each poem, each story, as a step in your literary career. Let it not leave your hand till you have done your very best with it. If you intend it to be a genuine work of art, make it so, if you can. This may seem a slow process, but it may prove the speediest in results. And after you have followed this advice, remember that even an editor is mortal, and like every other mortal, entitled to his proportion of mistakes." It is to be hoped that the word career, incidentally dropped in the foregoing, will not have a tendency toward making ingenuous youth selfish and self-conscious. Given a certain amount of skill and taste, literary art is only another name for literary conscience. Conscientious work is not necessarily artistic work, as many a poor devil has found out too late. But it may be. The heart comes first. A warm heart and a cool head, says Joseph Jefferson. The heart comes first, but heart without art is of no avail. The literary artist need not think sordidly on his or her career, and yet may cherish that decent regard for repute, that love of artistic perfection, which will bring the rewards of conscience and of honorable fame. At least the literary artist should be ashamed to do less well than in him lies. He should not niggle and polish for the love of niggling and polishing, but he should be remorseless in self-correction for the love of truth and art and beauty. And also, as already said, he should allow the editor that privilege of humanity, the right to blunder, remembering that the declined writer's revenge is the editor's own too vivid memory of mistakes, the ever-lengthening black list of errors in literary judgment, which every old reader of manuscripts turns to in the secret place of his own mind for melancholy penance and warning. End of 9,000 Manuscripts from the Century Illustrated Monthly Magazine, Volume 40.
Chapter titled Lady Florence Dixie from Celebrated Women Travelers of the 19th Century by William Henry Davenport Adams. This is recorded to celebrate the 9th anniversary of LibriVox. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Time was, and not so very long ago, when a visit to the wilds of Patagonia on the part of an English lady would have been regarded as a wonderful achievement. Nowadays it excites but little comment. The interest excited by Lady Florence Dixie's book Across Patagonia was the legitimate interest inspired by her fresh and lively description of unexplored and untrodden ground, and not the ideal curiosity which a sensational achievement sometimes excites. If one lady can make a voyage round the world, why should not another ride across Patagonia? To our grandmothers, a French or Italian tour was an event of novelty and importance. But nous avons changé tout cela. It is quite understood that no terra incognita exists into which our female travellers would fear to penetrate. Lady Florence Dixie frankly tells us her reason for venturing into Patagonia, and no doubt it is the reason which has actuated many of her sisters in their world wanderings. She went to an outlandish place so many miles away, as her friends called it, precisely because it was an outlandish place and so far away. She adds, "Palled for the moment with civilization and its surroundings, I wanted to escape somewhere where I might be as far removed from them as possible." Many of my readers have doubtless felt the dissatisfaction with oneself and everybody else that comes over one at times in the midst of the pleasures of life, when one wearies of the shallow artificiality of modern existence, when what was once excitement has become so no longer, and a longing grows up within one to taste a more vigorous unction than that afforded by the monotonous round of society's so-called pleasures. In this state of mind, she looked round for some country that would satisfy her requirements, and decided upon Patagonia, because nowhere else could she find an area of 100,000 square miles for equestrian exercise, where one would be free from the presence of savage tribes and obnoxious animals, as well as from the persecution of morning calls, invitations, garden parties, telegrams, letters, and all the other resources of civilization. To these attractions was added the thought, always alluring to an active mind, that there she would be able to penetrate into vast wilds untrod as yet by the foot of man. Scenes of infinite beauty and grandeur might be lying hidden in the silent solitude of the mountains which bound the barren plains of the Pampas, into whose mysterious recesses no one as yet had ever ventured. And I was to be the first to behold them, an egotistical pleasure, it is true, but the idea had a great charm for me, as it has had for many others. Accompanied by her husband, brothers, and three friends, Lady Florence left Liverpool on the 11th December 1878. Early in January, they reached Rio de Janeiro, of which she furnishes a pleasantly graphic sketch that gives a true idea of her descriptive powers. Nowhere, she says, have the rugged and the tender, the wild and the soft, been blended into such exquisite union as at Rio, and it is this quality of unrivalled contrasts that, to my mind, gives to that scenery its charm of unsurpassed loveliness. Nowhere else is there such audacity, such fierceness even of outline, coupled with such multiform splendor of color, such fairy-like delicacy of detail, as a precious jewel is encrusted by the coarse rock, the smiling bay lies encircled by frowning mountains of colossal proportions, and the most capricious shapes. In the production of this work, the most opposite powers of nature have been laid under contribution. The awful work of the volcano, the immense boulders of rock which lie piled up to the clouds in irregular masses, have been clothed in a brilliant web of tropical vegetation, purple and green, sunshine and mist. Here nature revels in manifold creation. Life multiplies itself a millionfold, the soil bursts with exuberance of fertility, and the profusion of vegetable and animal life beggars description. Every tree is clothed with a thousand luxuriant creepers, purple and scarlet blossomed. They, in their turn, support myriads of lichens and other verdant parasites. The plants shoot up with marvelous rapidity and glitter with flowers of the rarest hues and shapes, or bear quantities of luscious fruit, pleasant to the eye and sweet to the taste. The air resounds with the hum of insect life through the bright green leaves of the banana skim, the sparkling hummingbirds and gorgeous butterflies of enormous size float, glowing with every color of the rainbow, on the flower-scented breezes. But over all this beauty, over the luxuriance of vegetation, over the softness of the tropical air, over the splendor of the sunshine, over the perfume of their flowers, pestilence has cast her fatal miasmas, and, like the sword of Damocles, the yellow fever hangs threateningly over the heads of those who dwell among these lovely scenes. After touching at Montevideo, Lady Florence Dixie's party proceeded southwards to the Straits of Magellan and landed at Sandy Point, a settlement belonging to the Chileans, who call it La Colonia de Magallanes. Here they procured horses and mules and four guides, and having completed all the necessary arrangements, rowed along the shore of the famous strait to Cape Negro. On the opposite side they could distinctly see the Tierra del Fuego, and at different points tall columns of smoke rising up into the still air denoted the presence of native encampments, just as Magellan had seen them 4 centuries ago, when he gave to the island, on that account, the name it still bears. At last they started into the interior, and began their exploration of the wide region of the Pampas. Game was plentiful, and the fowling pieces of the party brought down numerous victims. As they advanced, they came into occasional contact with the Patagonians, and her observations of their physical character are important and valuable in relation to the marvelous accounts which we find in the old voyagers. "I was not so much struck by their height," she says, "as by their extraordinary development of chest and muscle. As regards their stature, I do not think the average height of the men exceeded 6 feet, and as my husband stands 6 feet 2 inches, I had a favorable opportunity for forming an accurate estimate. One or two there were, certainly, who towered far above him, but these were exceptions. The women were mostly of the ordinary height, though I noticed one who must have been quite 6 feet, if not more. Lady Florence speaks of the features of the pure-bred Chuelche, or Patagonian aboriginal, as extremely regular and by no means unpleasant to look at. The nose is generally aquiline, the mouth well-shaped and beautified by the whitest of teeth, the expression of the eye intelligent, while the form of the whole head indicates the possession of considerable mental capabilities. But such is not the case with the Chuelches, in whose veins is a mixture of Fuegian or Araucanian blood. Of these latter, the flat noses, oblique eyes, and badly proportioned figures excite disgust, and they are as different from a purebred Chuelche as a racer is from an ordinary cart horse. Their long, coarse hair is worn parted in the middle, and is prevented from falling over their faces by means of a handkerchief or fillet of some kind bound round the forehead. They suffer no hair to grow on the face, and some extract even their eyebrows. Their dress is simple, consisting of a chiripa or piece of cloth round the loins, and the indispensable guanaco cape, which is hung loosely over the shoulders and held round the body by the hand, though it would obviously seem more convenient to have it secured round the waist with a belt of some kind. Their horsehide boots are only worn for reasons of economy when hunting. The women dress like the men, except as regards the chiripa, instead of which they wear a loose kind of gown beneath the cape, which they fasten at the neck with a silver brooch or pin. The children are allowed to run about naked till they are 5 or 6 years old, and are then dressed like their elders, partly for ornament, partly also as a means of protection against the wind. A great many Indians paint their faces, their favorite color, as far as I could see, being red, though one or two I observed had given the preference to a mixture of that color with black, a very diabolical appearance being the result of this combination. We cannot follow Lady Florence Dixie through all her Patagonian experiences, which in their infinite variety must have fully satisfied her craving for new things. She hunted pumas, ostriches, guanacos, witnessed the wild and wayward movement of the wild horses on the plains, which for ages have belonged unto them, suffered from the burden of the heat and the attacks of the gnats, explored the recesses of the cordilleras, and came upon a broad and beautiful lake, on which, in all probability, no human eye before had ever looked, until at last she grew weary of adventure, and she and her companions turned their faces once more towards the commonplace comforts of civilization. All this and more she tells with much animation, quite unaffectedly, and in a style which, if marked by no special literary merit, is always clear and vigorous. One can do much worse than while away an hour by the fireside with Lady Florence Dixie's book in one's hand. One will close it with the conviction that the writer is a courageous, lively, and intelligent woman, who can ride across country with a firm hand and hold her own in any dangerous or novel position. End of chapter titled Lady Florence Dixie from Celebrated Women Travelers of the 19th Century by William Henry Davenport Adams. Read by Anusha Iyer, Mumbai.
Ninth Century Wooden Mask by Langdon Warner from the Bulletin of the Pennsylvania Museum, Volume 17. This is recorded to celebrate the 9th anniversary of LibriVox. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. In the February Bulletin was published an early Japanese mask of the head of a bodhisattva, which is the epitome of 14th-century repression. In this number is illustrated a mask 400 years earlier than that other, typical of the very height of expressive grotesque. Both masks we owe to the generosity of the late Mr. John T. Morris, who purchased them on one of his trips to the Orient. It could hardly have been realized when he brought them over that these two would prove to be the earliest, and in some ways the most important examples which would ever leave Japan, for it is safe to say that the days of such haphazard discoveries are over, and the Japanese Imperial Commission for the Preservation and Cataloguing of Antiquities has long ago set the seal of national treasure on all the known early and important masks. Ancient literature and modern scholarship are almost equally barren of references to the paraphernalia of the Bugaku dramatic dances, which barely persist to the present day. It is well known that certain demoniacal and godlike characters were represented, and the mask in the Pennsylvania Museum was no doubt worn by an actor who took the part of a demigod or of an evil spirit. While the generations of sculptors who produced the masks used for the no dramas from the end of the 15th century to the modern decadence are well known, one cannot hazard even a guess at the tradition or the family of the man who made this mask. Undoubtedly, he lived in Yamato, or in the adjoining region of the Yamashiro. Probably he was a priest who made temple images and dramatic masks. Every year at the season of the Matsuri, or festival of the local shrine, which no doubt was both Buddhist and Shinto in character, the robes, the banners, the portable shrines and lanterns, together with such masks as this, were brought out from the temple storehouse to be used in procession through the streets, and finally in the archaic dances performed on a high wooden platform within the temple compound. Every village boy was familiar with this medieval morality play, and knew more of the character represented by our mask than does the eminent scholar of today. It is doubtful if even the name of the part in which it was used can be correctly determined. Most surely the lines spoken in the stage business have been lost. Vaguely we believe that India and China provided the origins of it all, for the forms of the musical instruments which were used can be seen cut in the living rock of the 5th-century cave chapels in China, and painted on the walls of the caves of Ellora and Ajunta. There are certain parallels to the form of this mask which may possibly be traced in China and Java and India and the South Seas, but no man dare say that he has unraveled the tangled skein of evidence. It remains, therefore, to study the actual form before us. Stylistically, it cannot be far amiss to attribute its period to the early years of the Fujiwara regime, or even to the last of the Tempio period, a range of 100 years before the last quarter of the 9th century. The few examples in Japan which are unmistakably of the same period are always quoted as being of the Tempio period, but they lack something of true Tempio suavity as we know it in the scores of dated statues. Unless those times are misunderstood by us, the artists contented themselves with a perfection of Chinese Tang forms made elegant by a hint from India direct. It is hard to imagine them producing such peaked leanness, so little tinged with the mannerisms of the Buddhist academy. But perhaps this is too ingenious, and our mask with its few companions represents another tradition of that day, a parallel contemporary style. Till this is proved, it is best to stick to the 9th century, when the comparison with dated Buddhist sculpture is not so strained. The wood is probably hinoki, chamaesi paris obtusa, soft and apt for the sculptor's chisel, still the favorite of the Japanese carver. Its pungent sap discourages insects, and the grain is as perfect as was that of the old American white pine. The fact that this example fits over the whole head of the wearer, instead of being tied across his face, is a sign of antiquity. It is, in fact, a false head rather than a mask, and the inner surface follows with a certain amount of fidelity the outside contours. This inside seems to have been left bare, but the face was covered with gesso, lacquered and colored. The upper lip, the eyes, and the top of the head are pierced with large holes, 1/4 inch in diameter, set far apart, into which were securely pegged bunches of horse or cow hair, the bristly stubs of which still remain. It is important to notice that human hair was not used, and that neither cloth nor paper was laid on below the lacquer. The modern silk cord passes through holes just in front of the earlobes. Doubtless when the mask was in use, there was no need for an attachment to the shoulders of the wearer. It fitted securely and completely over his head, and one cannot be certain that these holes were contemporary with the mask. The mouth is slightly open, with the lips bared in a grin showing the thick teeth, with long eye teeth curving to the side. The lower lip has split off on the grain of the wood and been roughly restored to its original contour. Unlike many of the medieval and late Japanese masks, the expression on the face cannot be defined with a single word or named by an emotion. Fear, hate, malice, delight, resignation are some of those familiar to us. But here, with the shift in shadow, comes a play of expression that cannot be caught. The eyes are arched as if in affected surprise. While the grin is huge, it is not precisely horrible. Almost the effect is of some clumsily malformed creature who suddenly says boo to frighten a child. As part of a morality play or a mystery, it was quite sufficient to draw a laugh from the rustics gathered on the grass below the little stage. Perhaps it was some spirit in the old Indian legend, or possibly used merely in the buffoonery between the acts. For the fair of those days was no Oberammergau for reverent tourists. It was a holiday with harlotry players, shooting bouts, wrestling, drinking, and praying, and at the end a substantial number of pious pennies in the shrine box. The gods stalked and gesticulated on the stage, while the juggler and the storyteller and the sweetmeat seller set up rival attractions all about the sacred enclosure, and even the man who pulled teeth with his fingers held his crowd fascinated. An early dance mask like this is far more a part of the life of its time, and a more spirited and pungent memory than the labeled and documented masterpieces of Mancho, carver of masks for the great interpreters of No at the beginning of the 18th century. His delicate lacquered shells are preserved with camphor chips and wadded silk pads in black lacquered boxes, brought out perhaps to be reverently fingered by a connoisseur, or more rarely still, worn at a performance by the Tokyo Society of No. Ours is a merry heathenish thing, battered and nicked, with its bristles worn to the stumps by centuries of honest labor amusing the groundlings. There is less of the individual work of art about it than of folk art, like a ballad or a street cry used for years. Only when we are poverty-stricken for such realities do we think to put it in a museum with a ticket on it. Art is there in the subtlest form as well as the most obvious. Not only was the unnamed sculptor able to carve a wooden block into a splendid and living grotesque, but there is something of medieval Japan, the very origins of the theater, the art of pantomime and of dramatic dance, to be understood from this one object. To show how important masks have become, even in Japan, it is interesting to note that there are only 83 in the list of national treasure. Of these, 53 are definitely listed as made for the Bugaku drama, and 21 for Gigaku. The rest are undetermined. Barely a score of them all are as early as our example. Perhaps none are finer. The hope that in our Oriental excursions we may turn up others comparable to it is vain. But in the imperial museums of Nara, Kyoto, and in the storehouses of the ancient temples of Horiuji and Todaiji, are its few aged cronies, fat and silly, or lean and wrinkled, the shapes that convulsed the simple villagers or caused their flesh to creep, as they sat half the night watching the show under the stars by the shifting glare of fire baskets hung about from the limbs of great temple trees. End of 9th Century Wooden Mask by Langdon Warner.
Alle neun Kegel by Moritz Bermann. This is recorded to celebrate the 9th anniversary of LibriVox. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Alle neun Kegel bei Moritz Bermann. Es ist gar wenigen in Wien bekannt, dass sich auf dem Stephansturm eine Kegelschiebstadt befindet. Diese ist noch heute in dem kleinen Zimmer neben der Wohnung des Turmwächters und dahin kamen vor einigen Jahrhunderten an Sonntagnachmittagen die Gesellen, um sich da zu unterhalten. Diese Kegelbahn ist sehr kurz, man muss sich beim Ausschieben bücken und die Kugel, zwischen den Beinen durchsehend, von hinten nach vorn auswerfen. Von dieser Schiebstadt hat sich eine lehrreiche Sage erhalten, die ich euch erzählen will. An einem heiteren Septemberabend unterhielten sich auf dem Berghofe nach dem Abendbrot einige lustige Männer aus Wien bei Geigenspiel, Becherklang und Kegelschieben. Unter ihnen war einer, der das Spiel vollständig beherrschte, denn bei jedem Ausschube traf er alle 9 Kegel, und er war es daher auch, welcher immer den Sieg davontrug. Die Gäste hatten sich in der Abenddämmerung bis auf den einen bereits verloren. Dieser stand aber noch immer da, ein Mann von hoher, kräftiger Gestalt, jedoch verliederlicht im Anzug, den Ausdruck tierischer Leidenschaft in den durch Trunk und andere Laster unschön verzerrten Zügen, und schob Kegel ohne Ruhe und Rast. Wie gewohnt warf er stets alle 9, und er begleitete diese seine Geschicklichkeit mit lautem Beifallsgeschrei. Nebenbei goss er einen Becher Wein nach dem anderen in den nimmersatten Schlund, weshalb ihn auch die Wiener den Ewigtrunk hießen. Konrad der Ewigtrunk spielte und zechte so eine gute Weile fort, als der Wirt des Berghofes zu ihm trat. »Nun, Konrad«, sagte er freundlich, »habt ihr noch nicht genug gespielt? Es wäre Zeit, davon abzulassen. Ich begreife überhaupt nicht, wie es euch Vergnügen machen kann, da so allein fortzukegeln. Kümmert euch nicht darum, sondern bringt mir lieber noch Wein her. Mich dürstet fieberisch.« Der Wirt entfernte sich kopfschüttelnd, brachte den verlangten Wein und nahm die ihm trotzig hingeworfene Zeche in Empfang. Konrad ergriff neuerdings die Kugel und schob aus, aber diesmal verfehlte er sein Ziel, denn es hatte sich eine Hand, wie Blei so schwer, auf seine Schulter gelegt. Zornig blickte er nach rückwärts. Er sah da ein Männchen, ganz in Grau gekleidet, mit schneeweißem Gesichte, das einem Totenschädel glich und das den Wüstling aus hohlen, tiefliegenden Augen unheimlich stechend anstarrte. Die Haare Konrads begannen sich zu sträuben, so schreckenerregend war das Aussehen des kleinen Mannes, in dessen Nähe ihn ein kalter Schauer überlief. Indessen ermannte er sich, stürzte einen Becher Wein hinunter und rief zornig: »Was wollt ihr denn von mir? Ihr treibt sehr dumme Narrenspossen, lasst mich in Ruhe!« Dann ergriff er die Kugel wieder und wollte sein Spiel fortsetzen, aber die Gegenwart des unheimlichen Gefährten lastete auf ihm. Er schob abermals ein Loch. »Das ist zu arg bei allen Höllenkünsten«, fluchte Konrad. »Treibt meine Geduld nicht aufs Äußerste. Geht fort und stört mich nicht länger.« Da erscholl es mit eintöniger Stimme, die wie aus einem Grabe kam. »Lass ab, ewiger Trunkenbold, lass ab von dem Spiele. Wie lange willst du noch schieben im Mondenschein und Sternenschimmer?« »Spare deine weisen Lehren«, erwiderte Konrad. »Folge mir lieber zur Stephanskirche, wenn du willst, denn mich gelüstet, oben auf der Schiebstadt im Turme zu spielen. Dort, wenn du willst, spiele ich mit dir bis um Mitternacht, so daß die frommen Wiener glauben sollen, der böse Feind sei losgelassen.« Da flüsterte beinahe tonlos der Graurock: »Nun so komm, du unverbesserlicher Wüstling, wenn du Mut hast, kannst du oben mit mir eine Kegelpartie machen.« Konrad stürzte den letzten Rest seines Weines hinunter und machte sich mit seinem Begleiter auf den Weg. Sie gingen durch die menschenleeren Gassen, aber nur die schweren Tritte des Säufers waren zu vernehmen. Das Grauröcklein schien über dem Boden zu schweben, denn seine Schritte gaben keinen Nachhall. Wie Blei hing es sich an Konrads Schuhe, und als sie auf dem Turme oben angelangt waren, triefte der Wüstling von Schweiß. Aber er bemeisterte sein Grauen und fragte übermütig und höhnisch: »Wirfst du auch auf jeden Schub alle 9 Kegel um?« »Auf jeden Schub alle 9«, erwiderte der Unheimliche. »Ich wette darauf, und verliere ich, so zahle ich auf der Stelle jede Summe, die du begehrst.« »Angenommen. Merke aber auf, was ich sage. Du musst dich mit dem Rücken gegen die Kegel aufstellen, zur Erde bücken und zwischen den ausgespreizten Beinen die Kugel nach dem Ziele werfen. Kannst du das? Lass es gut sein. Gib die Kugel her. So wirf denn alle neun, rief hohnlachend Konrad und warf einen der Kegel zum Turmfenster hinab auf die Straße. Erst du, dann ich, donnerte ingrimmig der Graurock. Die Kleider fielen von ihm ab und ein entsetzenerregendes Totengerippe von riesiger Höhe, Sense und Stundenglas schwingend, zeigte sich den Blicken des vor Schreck halbtoten Trunkenbolds. »Also vorwärts«, rief es, »vorwärts, der Tod wartet nicht. Gelingt es dir aber nicht, alle neun Kegel zu treffen, so bist du mir verfallen und kommst nicht lebend vom Turme herunter. Höre, eben fängt die Stunde meiner Herrschaft zu schlagen an.« Es schlug gerade 12 Uhr. Zentnerschwer fiel die Geisterstunde auf das Herz des Liederlichen, Gottvergessenen. Das Fieber rüttelte ihn der Gestalt, dass er nicht stillhalten konnte. Er suchte mit klappernden Zähnen nach dem neunten Kegel, aber der lag unten auf dem Platze. Todesschweiß bedeckte seine Stirne. »Ich muß den neunten Kegel haben«, stöhnte er und kratzte heulend die Hände an der Wand blutig. Er stieß wütende Flüche aus, kniete neben die Kegel, zählte sie mehrere Mal, aber ach, es fehlte immer der neunte. »Ich muß den neunten haben«, schrie er in ohnmächtiger Verzweiflung. Da rief der Tod: »Nun, du toller Bursche, glaubst du etwa, ich brauchte den neunten Kegel? Der Tod trifft auch neune, selbst wenn es nur acht sind.« Darauf warf der schreckliche Menschenwürger die Kugel gewaltig vorwärts, die Kegel stürzten mit Geprassel zusammen, und Konrad, der ewig Trunk, sank neben ihnen leblos zu Boden. So fand ihn am andern Morgen der Turmwächter. Noch einige Jahrhunderte nachher war es Sitte, dass die Besucher dieser Kegelschiebstadt auf die Erlösung der armen Seele des Verunglückten einen Schub tun mussten. Der Schlemmer hatte sich wahrscheinlich in seinem trunkenen Übermute auf den Kirchturm begeben und da, nachdem er im Rausche einen der Kegel aus dem Turmfenster geworfen, sich wie wütend auf die übrig gebliebenen Kegel gestürzt, wobei ihn die von der Wand abprallende Kugel an den Kopf getroffen und getötet haben mag. Der fromme Sinn unserer Vorfahren unterlegte der Tatsache den sagenhaften Grund, um auch hier vor Übermaß der Leidenschaftlichkeit, die nur Schaden bringt, zu warnen. Ende von Alle neun Kegel von Moritz Beermann. Gelesen von Awai.
Awake, ye Muses Nine by Emily Dickinson. This is recorded to celebrate the 9th anniversary of LibriVox. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. This poem was sent by Emily on Valentine Week, 1850, when she was 19 years of age, to Mr. Bedoin, a law student in her father's office who was considered by young girls at that time a confirmed bachelor. Awake, ye Muses Nine! Sing me a strain divine, unwind the solemn twine, and tie my valentine. Oh, the earth was made for lovers, for damsel and hopeless swain, for sighing and gentle whispering, and unity made of twain. All things do go according, in earth or sea or air. God hath made nothing single but thee in his world so fair. The bride and then the bridegroom, the two and then the one, Adam and Eve his consort, the moon and then the sun. The life doth prove the precept, who obey shall happy be, who will not serve the sovereign, be hanged on fatal tree. The high do seek the lowly, the great do seek the small, none cannot find who seeketh on this terrestrial ball. The bee doth court the flower his suit receives, and they make merry wedding whose guests are 100 leaves. The wind doth woo the branches they are one, and the father fond demandeth the maiden for his son. The storm doth walk the seashore, humming a mournful tune. The wave with eyes so pensive looketh to see the moon. Their spirits meet together, they make their solemn vows. No more he singeth mournful, her sadness she doth lose. The worm doth woo the mortal, death claims a living bride. Night unto day is married, morn unto eventide. Earth is a merry damsel, and heaven a knight so true, and earth is quite coquettish, and beseemeth in vain to sue. Now to the application, to the reading of the roll, to bringing thee to justice and marshalling thy soul. Thou art a human solo, a being cold and lone. Wilt have no kind companion, thou reapest what thou hast sown. Hast never silent hours and minutes all too long, and a deal of sad reflection and wailing instead of song. There's Sarah and Eliza and Emmeline so fair, and Harriet and Susan and she with curling hair. Thine eyes are sadly blinded, but yet thou mayest see six true and comely maidens sitting upon the tree. Approach that tree with caution, then up it boldly climb, and seize the one thou lovest, nor care for space or time. Then bear her to the greenwood, and build for her a bower, and give her what she asketh, jewel or bird or flower. And bring the fife and trumpet, and beat upon the drum, and bid the world good morrow, and go to glory home. End of Awake Ye Muses 9, read by Michelle Fry, Baton Rouge, Louisiana.